Good morning. Welcome to Shattering This, the program which is devoted to those of you who, like me, have come to realize that all of the world's religious, political, economic, and military institutions are corrupt, even counterproductive. I am Yana. Our number, if you'd like to join us, is 877-300-7645. A judge in Louisiana has ordered the release of an inmate who has been in solitary confinement for more than 40 years. Scott, I'm going to tell you, I can't imagine being in solitary confinement for 24 hours. 40 years.
What? Why was he...
There is no crime. I mean, there is no crime that justifies solitary confinement for 40 years. Can you imagine being without anyone to talk to for 40 years?
No.
When the framers of the U.S. Constitution say there cannot be cruel and unusual punishment, what could be more cruel? Solitary confinement, no stimulation. Humans, we aren't made to be that way. We are a conversant, relationship-oriented creature. I mean, we have been created specifically to communicate with, to engage in a relationship with Yahweh and the covenant family. And while I understand there's a lot of people that are estranged from it, and that would be the vast preponderance of people, you can't take from people that need for companionship, that desire for companionship that was built into us from our Creator. 40 years. The judge in this case, James Brady, also banned prosecutors from trying Albert Woodfox, who is now 68, for a third time. He has been in solitary confinement since the 18th of April, 1972. It was after a prison riot resulted in the death of a guard. Vengeance. Woodfox was tried twice for the guard's death, but both convictions were later overturned. He's denied all charges. You know, our justice system is overly corrupt. It is ridiculously corrupt. Even with people like you and I who live in the relative freedom compared to Mr. Wilcox outside of prison, the whole system is gamed. The FBI presents falsified information. Police provide false testimony. The whole system is gamed. We have imprisoned thousands upon thousands of innocent people. And in this case, I don't know this man's story. But I know that for him to spend 40 years in jail for the crime that he was convicted of committing, which I don't even know if he committed, which was armed robbery, is absurd. And for there to have been a riot in the facility, perhaps the riot was the cause of belligerent, violent, disgusting guards. I mean, if we look at the attitude that is displayed by our military against women, men in the military against women, if we look at the belligerence that is shown in our society of police against law-abiding civilians, citizens, what do you think it's like in a prison? How much worse? Woodfox was confined for 23 hours a day, with an hour outside of his cell to walk alone along a tier of his cell, which is completely isolated from others. Exercise was permitted three times a week, but there were restrictions. Even on it, restrictions on personal property that he could have in solitary confinement, restriction on reading materials, restrictions on access to legal resources, restrictions on work, restrictions on visitation rights. Well, I tell you what. Louisiana state corrections officers should all have to endure what they put this man through. Originally convicted and imprisoned for armed robbery, he was found guilty of murder after the riot in which police, our prison officer, Brent Miller, was stabbed to death with a lawnmower blade. But a spokesman for the Louisiana Attorney General said that prosecutors would appeal to make sure this murderer stays in prison and is fully accountable for his actions. They don't want to be accountable for theirs, do they? Do you know that there are 80,000 prisoners in the United States that are in solitary confinement? 80,000. We're torturing 80,000 people. Stunning, that number. 80,000. They're held in 44 states. 25,000 in maximum security supermax jails. Conditions vary, but they include up to 23 hours a day of being confined alone, with no more than 1 hour a day of being able to walk along an external hallway alone. UN torture specialists want a global ban on all solitary confinement because it's torture. Washington, D.C. This is from CNN. Former defense secretary, and they're really not defense. We don't, our military does not defend America. Our military has never defended America. Never. Never. And that's stunning to hear. But America did not defend America, or the Defense Department did not defend America in the invasion of Iraq, in the invasion of Afghanistan, in the invasion of Grenada, in the invasion of Panama, in the invasion of Vietnam, in the invasion of Korea. We did not defend America in the Pacific theater of World War II, nor in the invasion of Europe, in the European theater of World War II. No one was seeking to invade America. No one was seeking to occupy America. We were not defending America. And if you go back through our war, Spanish-American War, Mexican-American War, the Civil War, the Indian Wars, the Revolutionary War, even the War of 1812, you can't name a battle where the American military successfully fought to defend America from outside aggression. Not once. Why call it a defense department when it's not defending anyone other than its own right to exist and to bankrupt the country? Defend its right to go off and break other countries, to interfere in the world, make the world worse, as we did in Afghanistan, as we did in Iraq, as we did in Vietnam. Anyway, former War Secretary Donald Rumsfeld now said that the goal of creating a democracy in Iraq was unrealistic, and that he was concerned when he first heard the idea floated by former President George W. Bush, a stark admission by one of Iraq War's biggest defenders. I'm not one who thinks that our particular template of democracy is appropriate for other countries at every moment of their histories. The idea that we could fashion a democracy in Iraq seemed to be, to me, unrealistic. I was concerned about it when I first heard those words, Rumsfeld told the Times of London last week. You notice he didn't tell the New York Times. He didn't tell the Washington Post. He told the Times of London. When America invaded Iraq with the stated purpose that we were going to create a democracy there, I mocked the President of the United States. It was laughable. It was impossible. It wasn't unrealistic. It was absolutely, wholly, and completely impossible. It could not have been done under any circumstances. at no time in history. So long as Islam has its grip on a culture, there is no way to extricate it from that malignancy. Islam is a criminal enterprise. Islam is surrender. There is no freedom in Islam, not of religion, not of speech, not of movement, not of politics. In Islam, there is no liberty of any kind under any circumstances ever. It's never going to change. It was unrealistic. What we did in Iraq was to break a country. We removed the best dictator in the Islamic world, and we gave the country to Shiites in Iran. It was the fait accompli. There was no other outcome that was even remotely possible. And by doing that, recognizing that Shiite Islam is 10% of the religion, 15% at the most, what we did is we started a civil war, not only in Iraq, but also in Syria. A civil war that has crossed the borders and is now in Yemen. A civil war that is never going to end. At least, not by man's doing. Over 1 million people have died because of those unrealistic goals. You know, false hope is a bad thing. I say it over and over again. It's my argument against Christianity. It provides false hope. False hope is a bad thing. This false hope that you could establish a democracy in Iraq and that Iraq was better without Saddam Hussein has led to the deaths of over 1 million people. It has led to the Islamic State. It has led to a civil war raging throughout the Islamic world. It was a hellacious decision. 10,000 Americans have lost their lives because of it. More will die. All because the President of the United States was not realistic. We'll be back in a moment. I have done several programs on the actual carnage of the foolhardy invasions of Iraq and Afghanistan. And what I've said, it's not just the 7,000 Americans in uniform that were killed there, because there was twice that number of Americans killed overall there, because we're not counting American government officials and American contractors. But that's just the tip of the iceberg, or of the mountain of blood, ocean of blood. You see, there have been, since we invaded Iraq and Afghanistan, and have asked the U.S. military to do something that is stunningly counterproductive, and to engage in a mission, as Rumsfeld has now acknowledged, that had no chance whatsoever of success, where it was impossible to tell the good guys from the bad guys, that we were not fighting an army. We were sent on a mission that was so convoluted and so ignorant that what our troops discovered is the very people we were allegedly trying to help hated us and wanted to kill us. And as a result, Americans have taken their own lives as they've come back from Afghanistan and from Iraq. The reported number is 22 a day have taken their lives. But that 22 a day comes from states that represent 40% of the U.S. population. States that represent 60% of the U.S. population don't even keep track of veteran suicides. And in addition to that, the states that are reporting claim that they're only reporting 70 to 80% of the veteran suicide deaths. Now, if you take 22 a day and you do the math so that you account for, adjust it upwards from 40% to 100% of the veterans, and you accommodate the 20 to 30% that is gone unreported even in those states, you end up with 80 a day of veterans returning from Afghanistan and Iraq who endured such hellish conditions, hellish circumstances, really, based upon the conflict of what they were asked to do and what they were told they were doing and the reality of the situation, as Rumfield has now announced. 80 a day that have taken their lives. Now, there are 365 days in a year. It's been almost 14 years. That number comes out to just shy of 400,000 is the real death toll associated with Afghanistan and Iraq. That George Bush's blunder has cost nearly 400,000 Americans their lives. Now, someone might say, well, your number is exaggerated because some of those individuals might have taken their own lives and suicide anyway. And I would say, yeah, that's true. But how many are not counted as suicide, that is, death by alcohol or death by cop, where they've acted belligerently hoping to be killed, or death by road rage, as was that happened, is the story we told yesterday. How many have been death by fistfight, where they chose to experience that life and death struggle that aren't counted in the total? So, Scott, you were sent an article by one of our favorite people, is William, the elevator man, for those who listen to the Blog Talk Radio Shabbat program, about suicide deaths in the U.S. military and their propensity versus the population at large, civilians. Want to share some of that?
Yeah, the suicide rates by gender and veteran status based on analysis of nearly 174,000 suicides in 23 states between 2000 and 2010. They found that the annual number of suicides per 100,000 population among people that have never served in the military, women kill themselves far less than men at 5.2 to 20.9. And then with veterans, it's with that same $100,000 population, mm-hmm. It's women 28.7, men 32.1. So both rates go up.
Whoa, so I mean women in the military who have served in the military
are six times kill themselves
six times more frequently than a woman in civilian life.
Yep. And
think of the staggering consequence of that. Women are so mistreated, so abused, not only by their rapists, but by the senior officers that exonerate the rapist and punish them instead. That they're taking their lives at 600% more than in society at large. Welcome back to Shattering Myths. We're trying to dissect some of the information in this article that Scott has had. And it's difficult in some ways because of the fact that we don't know whether or not the data comes from a properly screened pool. And what we mean by that is that while the information on women is pretty straightforward, on men, which you know, outnumber women in the military probably 10 to 1, there are majority of the states report suicide deaths for veterans, but those majority of the states are typically smaller states. For example, California does not report. Texas does not report. New York does not report. Florida does not report. So all of the largest states collectively do not report. So it's a majority of states, but a minority of the population reports. And so we don't have direct access to what to know for certain if the 22 states from which this 100,000 pool of individuals was pulled, if those states are all suicide veteran suicide reporting states. But here's some things we do know. Scott, amongst younger women, if what is the delta in propensity to commit suicide amongst younger women, veterans versus civilians?
Women, veteran women between the ages of 18 to 29 are 11 and a half times the risk to commit suicide than a normal civilian.
You know, if it was 11%, that would be significant. If it was 50%, it would be, I mean, a crisis. But we're not talking about 11% or 15%. We're talking about 11 and a half times. That's a staggering number. I mean, it's a number that should jolt society to say that absolutely, unequivocally, as a parent, you should never, ever consent to have your daughter go into the military, and should she want to serve, you should do everything in your power to discourage her. And you should have raised her knowing this information so that she does not go into a situation that is this prone to abuse her mind and character to the extent that life isn't worth living.
And for men in that same category, they're almost five times as more as they're five times the risk.
Whoa.
As a normal civilian.
Five times.
4.7.
It's just these are numbers that are just hard to even fathom. I mean, and we're not talking about just teenagers here. This is what you said, 18 to 29. Year olds. And what, let me tell you something, there are five times more. What that means is that of those that in the last 10 years would have served in either one of those two campaigns, the disasters of Afghanistan and the even greater disaster of Iraq, that they would be the ones who would have come back and have taken their lives before their 30th birthday. And so that group, the group beyond 29 that has taken their lives, that group, you know, is are returnees from Vietnam, maybe even Korea. And so Vietnam and Korea, the delta is significant, about 20%. But the delta for those under 29, which would be now just focusing expressly on those that were so savagely treated, so immorally treated by George W. Bush and his administration, that have come back broken. That if those individuals are five times, the men are five times more likely to take their own lives. And women, 11 and a half times. There's not many things in our society that's more important than this, but if you communicate this via the mainstream news media, and you do so in a responsible way, what are the only conclusions that can be drawn, Scott? That men who are 18 to 29, the vast preponderance of those who came back from Afghanistan and Iraq, and women of the same age group are either five times or 11 and a half times more likely to take their own life in suicide. What is the only conclusions that you can draw about the experience that they endured in Iraq and Afghanistan?
It's hell on earth. I mean, it's got to be.
That it was so disorienting, so
and this isn't even,
twisted, this that is, this life is, wasn't even worth living.
It's not even as simple as Iraq and Afghanistan. It's military in general.
Yes.
In this article, it's an LA Times .com article, and they have some stories in here where some of these people aren't even, they were just told that they were going to be shipped out to go off to war, and that's when they attempted to do it, and then they got discharged.
Wow.
They got some stories in here about sexual abuse, things like that. It's
yeah. the sexual abuse. It's obviously the sexual abuse that's driving the rate of women up. And not just the fact that they've endured sexual abuse, because women in society endure sexual abuse, not at near the rate, but it's that in the military, the greatest abuse is by the officers, your superior officers, after you've been abused. Now, the conclusions are obviously many, and some people, you know, patriots will say, you know, war is hell. But this wasn't war. We didn't declare war. The kinds of things that America has done and that our veterans have witnessed in war, you know, in Iwo Jima, for example, and in the carnage that we created in Germany, Dresden and Hamburg, Germany, in the cities that we firebomb night after night in Japan, you know, incinerating women and children alive. The kind of carnage that was witnessed by Americans and military has greatly exceeded what they endured in Iraq and Afghanistan. You know, to see all your buddies on a pole soaked in urine that fell through a tiger trap in Vietnam, or to see your buddy charge a hill in Vietnam and have half your comrades be shot to ribbons, only to, when you get to the top of the hill, giving it up and have the enemy return to the hill. And yet, something was different in Iraq and Afghanistan, where the carnage on the ground was much less amongst our troops, and yet the carnage of the mind was much greater. They knew what I know, that the country lied to them, that their country put them in a lose-lose scenario, that we ought not have been there, that we made a bad situation worse. And when you see your friends sacrificing their lives and their bodies to make a bad situation worse, it's very difficult to deal with that. And that was the problem, the disconnect between the indoctrination and reality, between what they were told and what they witnessed. Scott, I don't know if there's a much more important news story than that one.
Thank you, William, not me.
Well, thank you, William. You know, the story is that America's military is counterproductive. We are killing our own sons and daughters. They're not defending America. The politicians are destroying America by way of our military, destroying the world. And they're responsible for the deaths of all of those men and women. Over 300,000 of them, soaring perhaps to as many as 400,000. It's inexcusable. And America, if you're one of those that waves the flag, if you're one of those that are patriotic, if you're one of those that views the military as honorable and as service to you, if you're one of those that says that you're free because of the sacrifice made by our military, then you're part of the problem. You're a contributor to the rape of those women, to the cover-up of the rapes, to the carnage they endured, to the mental anguish that they have to live with every day because of where they were sent, because of what they were asked to do, because of this disconnect between patriotism and what they were told versus what they actually witnessed. Well, speaking of disgusting, took place quietly. But you know how the story of Malala, she was, it's M-A-L-A-L-A, she was the little Pakistani schoolgirl that the fundamentalist Muslims, part of the Taliban, sent out a goon squad to kill, and they, at point-blank range, they shot several shots into her head, but she survived, and she won a Nobel Peace Prize, I think, for her her stand against, of course, there was never a stand against Islam. It was always just presented as a stand against terrorism. Do you know that 8 of the 10 men that were indicted and jailed who were there trying to kill her, don't know if they were the ones that pulled the trigger or not, but 8 of the 10 assassins of that little girl were not only released from jail. Now, these men were all tried. They were all found guilty of attempting to murder Malala. They collectively, each of them individually, received jail terms of 25 years. Do you know that they were all released? They were all exonerated? Welcome to the world of Islam. You try to murder a little girl, and you're exonerated. In fact, you're a hero. We'll be back. A majority of Eritrea's population, according to Wikipedia, adheres to Abrahamic religions. Scott, is there a problem with that statement? Abrahamic religions. Ever heard of an Abrahamic religion?
I was just going to say I've never heard of an Abrahamic religion.
Did Abraham have a religion?
No.
No. Did Abraham found a religion?
No.
Is the covenant, its terms and conditions that make Abraham relevant? The only thing that makes Abraham relevant is the covenant, its terms, conditions, and benefits. Were any of the terms or conditions or benefits of the covenant, were they accepted by or guided, did they guide the religions of Judaism, Islam, or Christianity?
No.
Do you find the path to relationship, the God with whom you're going to have the relationship with, and the means to that relationship articulated in Judaism, Christianity, or Islam?
No, not even
no.
Not even,
so
no.
How could there be an Abrahamic religion unless the person writing this is so stupid, so ignorant, so irrational, that he would make such a idiotic statement? Is there any basis for it?
No. Are
you a scholar?
I am not a scholar.
Are you a theologian?
No.
But you know this is laughably stupid.
It is stupid.
Yeah.
And yeah, it is stupid. I mean, I know why he said it. I mean, the best lies are wrapped in truth.
Yes. Yeah, there's always... If you're going to fool people, if you tell them an outright lie, you have very slim chance of fooling them. But if you incorporate a shred of credibility, a shred of truth, and that your lie is a counterfeit, so that there's some attempt to make it appear credible, you're going to be far more believable than if you don't. So Islam tries to garner credibility from the story of Abraham, as does Christianity, as does even Judaism. Anyway, this story goes on. A majority of Eritrea's population, this is not the story, this is Wikipedia, because I wanted, before I read the story on Eritrea, I wanted you to have an idea as to what the problems might be there. Estimates of the number of Christians vary from 36% to 48%. The number right now is into the low 30s. And they belong to the Eritrean Orthodox Tewahedo Church. That would be an Eastern Orthodox Church. Roman Catholicism light. Not Roman Catholicism light. Roman Catholicism different. Between 52 and 64%, and the number is 64%, two-thirds of the populations are Muslims. Sunni Muslims. Okay? Eritrea's government may have committed crimes against humanity, including a shoot-to-kill policy on its borders, UN investigation says. It is not law that rules Eritrea, but fear, which this report details extrajudicial killings, sexual slavery, and forced slave labor. Slave labor, sexual slavery, and mass murder. The situation has prompted hundreds of thousands of people to flee the country. Eritrea declined to take part in the investigation. It has previously denied committing human rights abuses and say those leaving the country are economic migrants. The UN says many conscripts are made to remain in the army indefinitely, where they receive almost no pay. They are subjected to slave labor, and they are tortured as a form of punishment. A shoot-to-kill policy on the country's border, announced by the government in 2004 to prevent Eritreans from fleeing the country, has not been abolished. Despite several eyewitness reports and government statements suggesting that the policy was no longer being implemented, witnesses who tried to cross the border this year told the commission that soldiers shot at them and tried to kill them. Well, Islam is having a lovely effect on Eritrea. It's a country that really split away from others in Africa so that it could be influenced more effectively by Islam. It's worked out really well for these people, hasn't it? Ah, the joys of religion.